camera cloud that I heard from your bank. Of the base risk all the way back to the grow. It's a very important idea, I think, in general. I talk in the car about this in a broader perspective. But the halakhic system is very suspect of innovation. Rebbe gave the following example. There's something called Kiddush, right? We have Kiddushim all the time. Kiddushim in the Gemara. We have Kiddushim in terms of religious practice. Right? What we do from the day we get up, from the moment we get up till we retire and go to sleep, and if you take pictures of everything we do, it wouldn't be exactly as Rabbeinu Rav Ashi did. It would be different things in terms of exactly what we do. The way they wash Tzidayim might not have been exactly the same the way we wash Tzidayim. Their tefillin was basically the same, but different thing, different hidurim, different shitot have been adopted, etc. The tzitzis probably look a little bit different. There were chidushim as part of the halakhic process. Now, each generation paskins according to their rabbanim, but based on the core. There were doubts that arose that had to be decided post Gemara. Ashkenazim and Sfardim, right? Were Ravina Rashi Ashkenazim or were they Sfardim? And I was like, what did they do? Did they daven Nusach Sfardim, Nusach Ashkenaz? Did they have Hadassim at their Friday night table or did they not? Like, you know, did they say El Chadodi? No. Right? There were innovations. So my Rebbe pointed out there are two words in the Hebrew dictionary. One's Chidush and one's Shinui. They both mean newness, change, etc. Shinui focuses though on change. You're dumping the old and starting the new. Chidush focuses on innovation, but with the connotation of the fact that we're basing ourselves on the old. A cell phone was a chidush, but it's not a shinui, because all you're doing is taking the old rules that a Kadosh Baruch Hu implanted within the world, radio waves and electromagnetic radiation and the power of electricity and electromagnetism, and utilizing those forces to go to the next step, if you will. So go ahead.
So it would be more of a continuity than
something
of a constant pre-existing, as opposed to something
right.
That previously had no idea.
Exactly. You know, I wanted to elaborate on it a little more. It's the difference between, if you will, the chiddush of Yitzchak Avinu's avoda v'Kadosh Baruch Hu, which was different from Avram Avinu's. And the Shinoi of Esav. It's the difference between Ashkenazic and Sephardic Jewry. After the smoke cleared, even though in the initial phases of the argument, the reason that Chassidut was vehemently argued against by, if you will, classic Judaism, because they viewed it as a Shinoi. And it was only in the hindsight that, with the exception of a few holdouts who, you know, who still think the battle's going on, that now began to see it more as a chidush rather than as a shinui. So again, I opened up a whole massive discussions here. Ashkenaz Sfard, Kabbalistic innovations, Chassidus, which is also related to Kabbalistic innovations, versus, you know, classic, shall we say, more Lithuanian, for lack of a better term, Judaism. Each of these needs its own analysis. But the common denominator is, in order to have a confidence that it's a chidush rather than a shinui, an innovation rather than a change, is that every new minhag that arises, ultimately that's the crux of things here, because the halachic system has a certain elasticity by allowing for something called minhagim. What do you mean a custom? Well, I'm going to make a custom that every Thursday I'm going to wave the Israeli flag, and I'm going to put that in Shulchan Aruch. And I'm going to make a custom that every Wednesday I'm going to wave the American flag, and I'm going to put that in Shulchan Aruch too. And I'm going to say that that's binding, because we have the minig here. Right? Or that we have the minig on every Thursday, right before davening, to check the stock tables. That's the minig here. Right? Or the extreme, which is of course laughable. You know, in this shul we talk during davening. I know, you hear such such phrases. So what's wrong with that? But we see there's such a thing called minhag. Minhag, by definition, is a chidush. Hallel on Rosh Chodesh. We learned about it in a rather long tosis. This one may be too long, right? That was a chiddush. It wasn't practice. Rav was about to stop them, but then he saw, no, they're skipping, so it's okay. You know, what made it okay? So the Vilna Gaon gave over to his students that there are two types of mitzvos. There are mitzvos chiyuvios, mitzvos that are obligatory, and there are mitzvos kiyumios, there are mitzvos that are optional. For example, tefillin is obligatory, tzitzis is semi-obligatory. What do you mean by semi? That if you have the four-corner garment, then it's obligatory. And then there are mitzvos that are totally optional. For example, under certain circumstances, to go visit the sick in the hospital, if they're basically being taken care of, but I want to make them feel even better, so that's an optional mitzvah. There's no obligation. There's no violation of halacha by not going, but you get a mitzvah if you do. Concerning the mitzvah of living in Eretz Yisrael, so that's debated in the poskim, whether that's an obligatory mitzvah or whether that's an optional mitzvah. The Gra suggested that every single minhag that arises, if it's going to be a valid minhag, has to be at least a kiyum on a Torah level. Meaning, you have to be tapping into some kind of Torah concept. The Torah didn't obligate you to do that. But when you do that, you're fulfilling a Torah idea. For example, right now, I take out a tefillin and I daven. I have to. Now, if there was a specific need, I have a sick person at home, or I'm sick, or there was a terrorist attack and we're davening for divine protection at that point in time, so that could be a mitzvah in a Torah, we call tefillah ve'eitz tzara, tefillah in a time of suffering, a time of tragedy. And some hold that applies not only on a communal level, which is an explicit pasuk in the Torah, but even on an individual level, as a Torah commandment, an obligation. Let's say everything's great. I just want to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu by talking to him at any given point in the day. It's no rabbinic obligation, it's no Torah obligation. But simply speaking, that's what Reb Chaim Brisker pointed out, that's a kiyum on a Torah level. Because there's a concept called tefillah on a Torah level that everyone agrees to, and whatever you daven plugs into the fulfillment of that commandment. Reb Chaim Brisker took it as a davar pashut, as a simple way, and he saw no other way to see any other way. That even though the Rambam holds, we're learning about tefillah now in the fourth parak, the Rambam holds that tefillah is min haTorah every day, once a day. The Ramban holds that tefillah is min haTorah only in a communal time of tragedy. Maybe on an individual time of tragedy as well. That's depending how you read the Ramban. So the simple reading is that daily prayer for the Ramban on a Torah level is not there. It just doesn't exist. And Reb Chaim said, no, of course it exists. It's a mitzvah kiyumis. On a Torah level, it's an optional act of divine service to pray. He said, it's a davar pashut. There's no other way to go on that. I think probably, to some extent, what's motivating is, what do you mean, on a Torah level, davening every day is meaningless? So what are you doing? So you're not doing anything. It has to be that, rabbinically, they legislated tefillah, but on a Torah level, it at least would be a meaningful way of serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Otherwise, who are you to invent a brand new method of service of HaKadosh Baruch Hu? I'm not talking now about the chesed of tefillah, you know, about the fact that God lets us pray to Him and we get things out of it. I'm talking about the mitzvah of tefillah, that that's an act of divine service. So the Rabbanan waved a magic wand and they say, from now on, we declare that there's a commandment now to serve God in this way. Who says he wants you to? So it must have been that on a Torah level it was always optional every day, anytime, and the rabbinic law made it obligatory, at least to some extent, with Shachar's Mincha, and we'll learn now at length about Ma'ariv, to what extent that's obligatory. The same is true, said the Gra, about Minhagim. Minhagim, in order for them to be real, and that's why throughout the rabbinic literature, throughout the... I hear it from my rabbin, that term. Most people don't use that term. Rabbinic literature, it sounds like Shakespeare. But, okay, just, you know what we're referring to. Referring to the corpus of writings, the Rishonim, the Achronim, They're always looking at minhagim and they're analyzing them. And sometimes they abolish them. Sometimes they went to the community and said, this minhag, that's a disaster. We can't keep this minhag. And they eliminated it. Rabbeinu Tam is famous for pointing out that minhag has the same letters as Gehinnom. Of course it was a cute literary flair, but what he meant was that there's no such thing as, well, it's a minhag, that's what you do. No, it's a minhag that has to be analyzed by the Rabbanim of that era to see whether it's what we call, it's a term that we use in our Gemara too, whether it's a minhag vatikin, whether it's a minhag vasikin. Meaning, is it a minhag that we could assume was founded by people who knew what they were doing? And usually the litmus test is exactly this grah. Does it plug into some kind of concept that already preceded the minhag? So that's why by rights we ask, where does Modani come from? What do you mean? Someone decided to invent a prayer. So that's like if I decide to invent a prayer, that would be the first thing when you get up in the morning. So you should say, I pledge allegiance to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and to Chappelle's, and to the State of Israel, and the Jewish people. So probably if you would start such a minhag, you would be laughed out of normal Orthodox practice. Because what are you doing? Where did that come from? It has to plug into something. It's, again, we went a little bit off field, but it is an important concept, especially in an era that is always trying to be innovative, certainly in technology. Every day it's innovative. And in religion, too. Something my rabbi pointed out, that's part of the problem, you know, creating that balance. What do you mean? Kiddush is bad? Of course it's great. You know, let's have egalitarian service, because the whole world is moving toward egalitarianism. So, what? So it's a kiddush? Great, so it's a kiddush, but... We have chidushim. That's what you need, a lot of seichel hayashar to figure out what's a chidush and what's a shinui. And the only way that you could do that is being connected to the Torah in its totality, to be able to have absorbed all of the themes and the thrusts of Torah, so that you're able to judge whether any new idea that people propose is a chidush or it's a shinui, or any new minhag that wants to become developed, whether that is an innovation or a change. And one of the rules that I was given over by Meir Beim is, does it plug into a Torah concept? And even if it does, is it a contradiction to another Torah concept? Okay, so that's, again, a little bit far afield, but with that in mind, we ask the question again, well, where did Modani come from? So the Mefarshim give one of two explanations. Yerushalmi says that there's a tefillah that for some reason fell into disuse. People don't do this anymore. The Mishnah Berurah recommends that you should do it, but it's not recorded in Shulchan Aruch, maybe because it doesn't say it in the Bavli. But Yerushalmi says that you're supposed to say three short tefillos during the changing of the times. When you change over from night to the morning, so you say Mode ani lefanecha Hashem Elokai v'lokei avosai. So I would say Sani Me'afela La'ora, that you brought me out from darkness to light. And then when you move into the afternoon, after the sun moves toward the west, so then you say that I thank you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that you allowed me to live, you know, that first half of the day, and to be able, you know, to see the next half of the day. I'm paraphrasing because I don't remember the tefillos, so you could see how much I say them. Right? I always meant to do that, but I'm working on a lot of other things. So we'll get to that, we need it. And then at night, I said, thank you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that just as you mezaken me to see the sun rise in the east, you allowed me to see the sun rise in the west. And by doing so, you're constantly connected to Hashem Yisborach, recognizing and, as the Meshech Chochma puts it, breaking through the mask of nature and seeing that the gift of life is not just day by day, but it's really second by second. People don't do it. So the suggestion was that this minhag, which was created by a work called the Sefer HaKavanos, I don't know who wrote it. I don't see Arizal. I don't know. I don't know who... No, not the Sefer HaKavanos. Seder Hayom. I don't know who the Seder Hayom was. He's the one in whose writings, the Mogen of Rome, quotes in the Seder Hayom to say, Modani Lefanecha, as you say. So someone suggests that was a transmutation, if you will, of the prayer of the Yerushalmi. which basically is saying thank you Hashem for waking me up. That's the gist of the prayer. How come they modified it? They explain because the minhag was suggested as a chidush to say it right away as soon as you wake up, as soon as your eyes open, right? So this way you're right away connecting to Hashem even before you get involved in anything. And since the original prayer of the Yerushalmi had the name of Hashem in it, Hashem Elokai, and they didn't want to say the name of Hashem before they were more clean, if you will, before they washed their hands and got dressed properly, etc., so they created a modified tefillah that omitted the name of Hashem. That was one suggestion. The other suggestion is that it's based on Elokai Neshama, right? Because the Gemara has in Masechta Brachos later that soon after wake up, you say Elokai Neshama Shenasati B'Torohi, etc. Tavarasa Toyasarta. Once again, that's also a tefillah that's recognizing the fact that you're awake, invigorated, etc., but it also has the name of Hashem in it. So again, this innovation to start off with a tefillah that has the gist of Elokai Neshama Shenasati B, but without the name of Hashem. Interestingly, the Rishonim already discuss that is there such a halacha that you're not allowed to mention the name of Hashem before Netil Sidayim? Because they take a look at that Gemara, and the Gemara says that as soon as you wake up, you say, Elokai Neshama Shenasati. So the Rosh is the first one to address it. He says, how could you say Hashem's name without being properly dressed, and especially keeping in mind that people didn't sleep in pajamas typically? Just to put a blanket over them, but they didn't have clothes on. So the Rosh writes that when the Gemara says that you say Elokai Neshama right away, it means after Netil Sidayim. It means relatively right away. So the Rosh already raised that issue, that it's inappropriate to say the name of Hashem without washing first. So in order to keep the thrust of trying to praise Hashem at the first second of wake up, then he developed this prayer. And it's very interesting. It's such a basic tefillah at the beginning of the Siddur, Modani. If you look in the history of it, you see it was a relatively new innovation in the, I guess, 1400s, 1500s, 1600s. I've got to check up who the Seder Hayom was. But my impression is that it was someone who was highly influenced by Kabbalah. Let's just end over the following. What does the word modeh mean?
Acknowledge.
Right. So modeh is a tricky word. If you look in Tanakh, so most of the time modeh... Right, so most of the time modeh means I admit, or like vidui. Vidui is related to the word modeh.
In
more modern Hebrew, but it's not just modern Hebrew. You have it in certain places in the Mishnah, the Gemara. In terms of Tanakh, I'd have to do a little more research to see how many times it means the other thing. But we take it also to mean thank you. So many of the commentators point out that it's the same thing. Because the first step to thanking is acknowledging. That's, what does thank you mean? It's just empty words. Thank you means that I recognize the fact you did something for me. So they're very much related. Some want to suggest that in the modin tefillah in Shemon Esrei that we have both meanings. It says modim anachnu la. How does it go? Modim anachnu something. Modim anachnu la. Shatov Hashem Elokeinu Elokei Avoteinu. Lalamvaed, Surchayenu, Maginashenu, Atul Dovidor, Nodel Lachon, Svetulosecha, Al Nisecha, Al Niflosecha, etc. So there's two modims there. There's modim and nodeh. So I want to suggest, it's not my own, I think I sort of elsewhere, that those two modims are two meanings of modim. The first modim means we acknowledge, and the nodeh means we thank. So, and I suggested the following idea. This, I think, is a chidush, maybe a shinui, that there's a difference between modeh when it's attached to sheh and modeh when it's attached to al. Modeh al is thanks. Thank you on. In English, we would say thank you for. Modeh sheh, which literally means modeh that. So I would translate that as I acknowledge that. So if you use that rule, so then the proper translation of modeh ani lefanecha melech avikeom sheh chazarti min nishmasi would be, I acknowledge the fact that it is you who returned my neshama. Now, there's a lot to be said, which I'm going to deliberately gloss over. This is an article I read in Geshem magazine. Those interested, I can give you the article. But the Moda'ani Tefillah is a reference to the return of the soul. What do you mean return of the soul? We're not dead. So, what is it referring to?
You're 1/40
dead, isn't it?
Right?
I'm sorry?
Aren't you like a fraction?
Fraction dead.
Yeah.
The Gemara in Brachas says that sleep is a 1/60 of death. Right. So what I was very fascinatingly made aware of is that that notion that we're all so accustomed to, the fact that sleep, which is a very, also scientifically, very funny kind of state, they don't really have that, scientists are struggling a little bit. What exactly goes on during sleep? But religiously, we've been taught that sleep is basically, as you said, based on the Gemara, that it's partial death, meaning it's a time when we don't know what these terms mean, but it's hard to speak about it in quantitative mathematical terms, but that part of the soul soars heavenward to give judgment, as the Gemara indicates in Sefer Rosh Hashanah. Doesn't speak about the soul leaving, but it speaks about judgment every night. When returned, give more invigoration to the body. There's a notion that appears in certain books, certain modern books, that and all the sins are forgiven. Where did that come from? I don't know. I know of no source that says that. All the sins are forgiven just because you go to sleep? Where'd it say that? Anyway, but that idea of the neshama leaving at night and returning during the day is most elaborated upon in the Sifrei Kabbalah. In the Gemara, it's only alluded to. That's what you just said about that Gemara, about the 60th of sleep. So with this article that I read in Geshe magazine, I was trying to say is, it's only a Kabbalistic idea. Not everyone agreed to it. So that kind of approach, I had a very hard time with. To be prepared to say that there's a machlokis between the entire Kabbalistic tradition and the Gemara, and not to view the Kabbalah as like a parallel work to the Gemara, I found very, very objectionable.
There's machlokis between Kabbalah and Halacha.
Sometimes, yeah, but as who's supposed to be the main author of, let's say, the Zohar? Who's supposed to be the main author, right? I'm not to be very rigorous about it. The notion of the fact that he wrote every single word in the Zohar, although there are people who hold that way, I don't think it's correct. Because there are references in the Zohar to people who were later than Shimon Yochai. There are references to Tanaim who were later, to Amoraim who were later. So if you will, the fundamentalist approach, and I say that without any rancor, is that he wrote those passages b'nevuah. This is what they would have said. But this is what they eventually would say. But a very standard approach is that the Zohar was a, just like the Gemara, was a work that had layers to it. Shimon Yochai wrote some of it, and others added additions to it. The radical other approach is that the whole thing is made up. Right? That's as you look in the Encyclopedia Judaica, you'll see those shitot on that. That the whole thing is made up. So I find that very objectionable, and I'll tell you why. Because as we learned in the Ramchal last Zman, Torah is not just wisdom. Torah is the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu reveals himself to us. And therefore we very much believe in Hashgacha in Torah. There's a divine providence that accompanies Torah study and Torah, the continued revelation of Torah throughout the centuries. So to say that so many thousands of Rabbanim and Talmidei Chachamim are putting so much energy into studying a work that's just wrong from the beginning to the end, I find it very difficult. Now again, that itself is not a solid argument. You don't build a religion based on that kind of argument. But that to me puts it over the edge, that other approach that says the Zohar is just totally made up. Find it very objectionable. But let's go back. It's machlokas, right? So let's go to Shimon Yochai. Who's the Shimon Yochai in the Gemara? How is he referred to? Rav Shimon. You ever come across him in the Gemara, once in a while? Is he always agreed upon by everybody?
Yeah.
So I thought, of course there's going to be machlokas in the Zohar and the Gemara. Because the Zohar represents a certain viewpoint. Right? So I never quite understood why, you know, there's a lot of discussion about this. Who wins? There's a machlokas between the Kabbalah and the Gemara. Why is it any different than a machlokas between Tanoim and the Gemara? Or between when Rav Shimon himself loses in the Gemara? Right? So that itself doesn't bother me. The fact that machlokas doesn't bother me to view it as authoritative. In any case, I just mentioning that idea of the return of the soul during the day is something that is only alluded to in the Gemara. It's never mentioned explicitly. Right? The most you'll get in Midrashim and Gemara is the notion of being refreshed. Right? In the Zohar, it speaks about it in more explicit terms. Right? But that's not surprising, because he mentioned before that the way I understood, I got this idea specifically from Rabbi Chaim Zimmerman, who used to be a controversial rabbi in Chicago, but the enormous Talmud Chacham, he pointed out that the Zohar is not primarily mysticism. The Zohar is the inner dynamic. The Zohar, primarily, the Kabbalah, primarily tries to give over what goes on in the spiritual behind the scenes when you do mitzvos and averos. So it fits very nicely. You wouldn't expect it to be in the Gemara to speak in those kinds of terms, that the neshama leaves at night and comes back during the day. The Gemara deliberately hid all that stuff. It wasn't interested in revealing that in the Gemara. It was only in the hidden works that it had such elaborate discussion. So I see no contradiction there. This person made a very big deal about it in his article, and he was trying to put forth the fact that it's a new idea. But it's just fascinating to see the layers here. So that Moda'ani is very much based on that, because what does it say there explicitly that it doesn't say anywhere else as explicitly in the davening? Moda'ani lafanecha she'achzar tivinishmasi. Right? It says it explicitly because that's influenced by the Zohar. As opposed to take a lakai neshama, what does it say there? Neshama shenasata bi tahoriti, right? Tava rasa, tava yitzarta, tava fachta bi, tava shamar bikirbi, vata asid, litla mimeni lachzira bi lasid lavo, baruch Hashem, hamachaz neshamos lefgor mason, who returns souls to dead bodies. Who to dead bodies?
Can you infer that from being a 60 of
death? Oh, right, exactly. But if you wanted to be an anti-Zohar stickler, right? So then you could say that Machaz in Hashemah of Gar Mason only refers to Tchias and Mason. But then you have the Kasha, why you're mentioning that right now? In the morning, first thing when you get up. Right? So I would suggest that in the times of Chazal, the bracha they gave had an illusion that Machaz in Hashemah of Gar Mason had two meanings. The Tchias and Mason that was mentioned in Elkai Neshamah, and the mini resurrection that just occurred at wake up. Right? With what you just said. And then the Moda'ani tefillah made it even more explicit. Sheikh Hazar to be Nishmasi, being influenced by the Zohar. Okay, a little bit more scholarly. Okay, good. Let's stop. I'm sorry I went all over. And Beth Hashem today we'll try to catch up a little bit in terms of I missed the day last week.